Be amazing. You know, I've been able to have a lot of really cool experiences through my life. I mean, you know, you, just like me, have had a lot of cool experiences. And I bet there's a common theme to yours than the same that's in mine. You know, I was able to, for instance, let me give you some of mine that I've loved memories. I was able to preach chapel for the Kansas City Royals, the Cleveland Indians, a few years ago. Charlie, I was able to go. I met Horl Hershiser. He was the chapel guy for the Indians. I preached to one team while the other was doing batting practice, and the other team is on Sunday morning while the other team was doing batting practice. Stayed at Keith Lockhart's house. He was a second baseman for the Royals, and man, it was an incredible experience. Ozzie Smith, one of the greatest shortstops to ever play the game of baseball. He's so famous, so good, he had a nickname called the Wizard of Oz. He had a retirement ceremony. I was able to go to his retirement ceremony, stay in the hotel with the Cincinnati Reds the night before, then the next day in St. Louis, go to the Reds and Cardinals game when he retired, and it was amazing. I was able to go to the 1995 World Series, the sixth game when David Justice hit a home run when the Braves beat the Indians for the pennant. It was amazing. And I was able to do all of those things because I know a man. I know a man. I know a man named Charlie Mitchell. Charlie Mitchell played in the majors. He's been a faithful member of our church. Here today, he's a deacon in our church. And he invited me. I was able to go to those things because I know him. It's the only way I got in. I was able to go to the 2000, January 8, 2000, the Bills-Titans playoff game, and the Titans won last second on what immediately became known as the Music City Miracle. I stayed to the end. I watched it. I was there. Why? Because I know a man. I've been invited to the White House to meet with the president and to infield at NASCAR races because I know somebody. Here's the thing. You've heard the saying. You've said the saying. It's not what you know. It's who you know, right? That's true in everything, including how you get into heaven. So go with it, right? I mean, that's true. And so today we're in this series called He Is. It's an affirmation of the I Am statements of Jesus. Today we're going to talk about, as Scott read a moment ago, that He is the way, the truth, and the life. In essence, here's what that means. It's not what you know that gets you into heaven. It's who you know. You can know all the Bible verses. You can know all the answers. Man, you can do all this, but if you don't know Jesus, you're not getting in. It's not what you know, it's who you know. It's not a list of rules you keep. It is a relationship with Jesus. So here's the question. Do you know Jesus? Do you know Jesus? And so let's read this verse that Scott just read. Let's read verse 6 of John 14. It says, Jesus said to him, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. Now, each week when I preach to you, I do a study, and there's a lot of things involved in study. There's exegesis, there's breaking this passage down, sometimes there's word studies, there's this, and you know, I'm looking for how can I frame this message out in points to help our people remember and get it. This was easy. I mean, the 3 points, you read it, they pop off. The way, the truth, the life, right? And so Jesus gave us these 3 points, and so let's look at these 3 points, and I'm going to camp out on the way a lot longer than the truth and the life, okay? We're going to talk about some of those things in a few months in a sermon on John 10:10 that we're going to do, outlining some vision for you, but I'm going to camp out on the way more than the truth and life, but I'm going to hit them all three, so let's start with the way. Now, let me give you some context to set this up that'll help you better understand what's going on. Jesus is at a party with his disciples. Basically, it's a private party. They're celebrating Passover together. Jesus has done this for 32 years. He's now 33, and this is his last Passover, as tomorrow he will be crucified. He'll be arrested later tonight. And so he wanted to celebrate this last Passover with his disciples, and they had rolled with him for 3 years now, but they still really didn't grasp and get all of who he was. I mean, they knew he was going to redeem them, but they didn't quite know how, and deliver them, but they didn't quite know how. They're still thinking Roman, you know, he's going to end Roman occupation. What's he going to do? They're trying to get it. And so Jesus leveraged this moment to really teach them some important truths before he jets back to heaven, because he's only got really a few more hours before his crucifixion. Then he's going to spend 40 days, but he wants to teach them some important things right now that will be emblazoned in their brain. So if you remember, this is the night where he teaches them humility by washing their feet. And then he basically tells them, hey, one of you is going to betray me tonight. They're all stunned. They're like, is it me, Lord? Is it me? Is it I? Because they're like, am I going to do it? The only one who knew was John, because Jesus told him in the dinner. And so they're struggling with that. And then Jesus said, hey, I'm about to go away. Where I'm going, you can't come. And they're like, what? I mean, they're dazed, they're confused, their faith is sort of shaken because they have left everything to follow him. They've left their family, they've left their career, they've left jobs, they've left everything to follow him. And they're like, what are you talking about? We're just getting started. Where are you going? Peter says, hey, why can't we come with you? Where you're going? And you're not going to die for me. Basically, I'm going to die for you. You see, Peter wanted to be the hero, right? I mean, everybody wants to wear the Peyton Manning jersey. No one wants to wear the Will Levis jersey. And so everybody wants to be the hero. Jesus is the only hero, and Jesus said, Peter, I know you want to come. You can't come with me now, but Peter, before the rooster crows, in other words, before morning, you're going to deny you even know me three times. And so, man, they're confused. Their faith is shaken. They're dazed. They thought they were going to show up and, man, have this incredible party with good food, good friends, good wine. They thought their hearts would be merry, and, man, their hearts are heavy. And that's where Jesus speaks words that are so important, so powerful for us today, when he says, let not your hearts be troubled. My Father's house are many rooms. I'm going to prepare a place for you, and if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you into myself, that where I am, there you may be also. Now, these are very powerful words. These are incredible words that you need to hang on to. They really ministered to me this week and thinking through them and thinking through my message and because, man, we can all relate to these disciples with troubled hearts, can't we? And so these are very important words, and it's a word picture, really. It's a word picture. As he's telling them, trying to calm their troubled hearts, he gives them a word picture to help them to understand the destination of all people who believe in him and the way to get there. You see, back in that day, weddings were typically arranged. And a good friend of mine, J.D. Greer, I was reading some stuff, and he pointed this out, and it's really cool. The weddings were typically arranged, but not always, but sometimes they were arranged. And you've heard of arranged marriages, and you know sometimes that works out good, and sometimes that would be pretty bad. It would be risky, right, girls? I mean, think about it from your perspective. I mean, as a little girl, your mom and dad might arrange for you to marry some guy, and you look out and you think, oh no, daddy, he's got a face only a mama could love, right? Or you could look out and you could go, oh, he's cute and adorable. But see, that's a risk, because ladies, you know as well as I do, most dudes, they're sort of like puppies. They can be cute and adorable when they're little, grow up and have a face like a bulldog eating a wasp, right? And so I mean, that's a risky proposition. But not all marriages were arranged. There were some that happened just like it does today. For instance, you know, some guy, he's out, he sees a girl, and he's like, whoa, and he walks up to her and says, hey, you must be from Nashville because you're the only 10 I see, right? I mean, guys don't really know how to flirt. They just know how to make things awkward, right? You know that. And so he goes, and after a few thousand crash and burns, most dudes finally find a blind sucker that thinks he's cute and adorable. And so he's interested in her, and he goes home and tells daddy, me found woman, me want woman, right? And so his dad, I mean, he talks it over with his dad. And his dad's like, okay, son, if his dad agrees, then he goes to the girl's daddy. And he goes to the girl's daddy, and he works out a deal. And if the girl's daddy agrees, then the girl's daddy throws a massive party. And the groom comes, and he takes a really good glass of wine during the party in front of everyone when everyone's watching, and he offers the girl a glass of wine, and if she accepts, she's saying yes to the dress, right? I mean, she's saying, yes, I will, and the party turns into a rager at that moment. Now, here's what happens. The guy, he goes home, and he begins to prepare a room onto his parents' house for he and his bride to live in. Now, You're like, why? He's moving in with mom and dad. Well, that's the custom then, right? I mean, they didn't buy their own place, rent their own place. Typically, they moved in with mom and dad. They'd build a room on. They sort of had their private room, but they were with their mom and dad. And you're thinking, oh my goodness. Hey, folks, we're getting back there, I believe, okay? You know as well as I do, that seems to be where we're headed. Might not be all bad because of the influence, but I mean, that might be where we're headed. And so they would build a room on, and when the guy was through with the room, he would go get his bride and bring her home, right? Here's the kicker. The kicker was that the groom, the guy who was building on the room, he didn't get to decide when the room was finished. His dad decided when the room was finished. That's probably a good idea because most young guys, you know, they're probably going to throw up, you know, some plywood, put them a big screen TV, a recliner, nothing else. Hey, this is cool. Bring her on, you know? Dad's the one that decides, no, it's not ready. And so the bride didn't really know when her groom was coming. So what she would do is she would go home, put a lamp or a light candle in the window and wait for her groom. Maybe it's tonight. You never know when he's coming because his dad is the one who decides. Is this starting to ring a bell with a lot of things Jesus is saying throughout his ministry? Like, hey, no one knows the time. No one knows when Jesus will return except the Father. It's he who has set time. Or the parable of the 10 virgins, where Jesus tells this parable about 10 virgins who go home. They put the lamp in the window, connecting to this custom. They put the lamp in the window to wait for the groom. The groom comes. Some of them are ready with their lamp. Some are not. And he goes on without the ones who are ready. Does it remind you of some things? You see, Jesus is using a common word picture here when the disciples' hearts are troubled greatly to help them realize that when your hearts are troubled, as a believer, you can always know that Jesus has gone to prepare a place for us and he will return on the day set by the Father. And that should bring great encouragement to you. This is not your home. This is not your home. There's something greater and it can give you hope in the darkest of times, right? And so Jesus is using this word picture to give encouragement to those whose hearts are troubled, and that speaks well to me. And so he's saying that heaven is the destination of all who believe. It's not the destination of those who don't believe, because the only way there is through him. He is the way, the only way. It's exclusive. There are no other ways. You know, when I use my GPS every day, practically. I even use it when I know where I'm going just because it might tell me to go a different route because there's traffic on this route. See, that's what your GPS does, right? I mean, your GPS, when I plug in a destination, it will give me multiple routes. It'll give me the quickest route. It'll give me the shortest route. It'll give me alternate routes. I use it because, man, when I'm going from here to Nashville, if there's a wreck, a crash on the 24 up, you know, 5-10 miles, it might say cut here. You know, I don't want to get into that. So it'll tell me an alternate route. You see, a lot of people, they think that's what happens with their eternity. I plug heaven into my eternal GPS and it's going to give me multiple routes. It gives me the Islam route. It gives me the Buddhist route. It gives me the Mormon route. It gives me the Christian route. It gives me the New Age route. It gives all these, and that's not what Jesus says. Jesus says, there are no other routes. I am the way. I am the truth. I'm the life. I'm the only way. A few years ago, Franklin Graham, he was invited to speak at the National Prayer Breakfast, National Day of Prayer, Washington, D.C., pretty big deal. He was invited to speak, but then Franklin made a statement. Franklin Graham's Billy Graham's son. He made a statement that got the attention of the national media. He said, and the people who run the prayer, he said, Jesus is the only way to heaven, which is what I'm preaching today. Well, the national media got a hold of this, and they ran with it, and they said he just offended most Americans. Even evangelicals under 30, they said, do not believe that Jesus is the only way to heaven. So Franklin Graham, when they approached him about it, what did he do? He doubled down. He doubled down and said, I'm not backing off for anyone. Jesus is the only way to heaven. They revoked his invitation to speak at the National Day of Prayer. Now, here's the thing with that. You know, they revoked it, and I want you to understand, it has always been difficult to say that Jesus is the only way to heaven. It's always been a risk. It's always been very difficult from the day Jesus was alive. Today, it's very, very difficult. We're called bigots. We're called hate mongers. We're called anything. But what I want you to understand is today, here's the truth. I'll never get to speak at the National Prayer Breakfast. Here's the truth. There is no way other to be right with God than through Jesus. There is no other way. He is the way. Now, you would say, oh, Pat, that's hateful. I want you to understand, I'm not the one who said that. I'm the messenger. I'm only repeating what Jesus said. I'm only repeating what Jesus said. When we talk about Jesus being the only way, we're not coming up with that. That's not a new thought. That's not something. I truly believe it. And because I truly believe it, it would be hateful for me not to tell you that. You see, many people think that it's hateful for me to tell you or to say Jesus is the only way. That's hateful. It's not respectful or tolerant of the Muslims and the Buddhists, and you know, it's not No, it's not hateful. It's loving, because I truly believe without Jesus you're going to hell. I truly believe that most of the world's not going home to be with the Father when the Son returns, but on the day the Father said. I truly believe that, and I want to take as many as I can. And so the loving thing to do is to tell people the only way is not through your own righteousness or your own good works or through the eightfold path or through this. It's only through Jesus. That's why Easter, that's why we want you to really get busy for Easter and to tell folks that heaven is the destination that you want, and Jesus is the only way. He's the only way. Now let's look at the fact that he's the only truth. He's the only truth. Now people talk about truth, and truth is sort of tricky today, isn't it? I mean, you know, people talk about, hey, it's my truth. You share your truth. You hear that all over, you know, it's my truth, it's your truth, because truth is subjective. It's just something that we can come up with. What's true for you might not be true for me. What's right for you might not be right for me. See, that gives us this license to do whatever we want to do and make our own path, doesn't it? It gives us a license to say, well, I don't believe that's true, so I can do whatever I want to do. But here's the news. Truth is not subjective. Truth is not some subjective. It's absolute, because it's not a philosophy. Truth is not just something you study in university. It's your philosophy class, right? It's not a concept that can change from culture to culture, time to time, person to person. Truth is an absolute because it is a person. It's not a concept, a construct, or a philosophy. It is a person. His name is Jesus. I am the truth. Now, what does that mean when Jesus said, I am the truth? It means that Jesus is ultimate reality, folks. Jesus is ultimate reality because he is the supreme revelation of God. That's what it means. It means that Jesus is the supreme revelation of God. When Jesus said, when you see me, you have seen the Father. So Jesus is the ultimate reality because he's the supreme revelation of God. This means he's the lens through which we should see everything in the world and look at everything in the world. Now, I want to work this out with you very practically for a moment, because life is very confusing. There's a lot of lies thrown at us throughout our lifetime. You know, we're lied to by culture. We're lied to by Hollywood. We're lied to in the music industry. We're lied to in magazines. We're lied to in TV shows. Everything shapes our mind to feel something, right? We're lied to by our emotions. We're just lied to. We're told all these messages. We're given all these messages about what we should do, what's acceptable, what's not acceptable. How do we know? Because that continues to change. It continues to fluctuate. And so surely there's more. How do we know? Well, we can know because there's something that never changes. Let me give you an example. You know, today, I was watching something the other day. I saw an advertisement for a brand new sitcom that's coming on. Some of you love sitcoms, and it's a sitcom, and all it is it's gay people living together, three gay guys living together, and you know what? It seems like it's incredibly funny. They seem wholesome. They seem funny. Man, and it's a desensitization. It makes me go, wow, that's not too bad. I mean, what? And then, hey, it's not, if you, you know, in here, and maybe that's the deal. Here's what I need you to understand. The heterosexual is, which is what I am, obviously, that's is worse and more pronounced than the homosexual. Because, you know, in every show, you've got couples that just, man, it's like, if you're dating, you're having sex. Right? If you're dating, you're having sex, you're living together, you're and so you got all this culture, every song, every TV show, every movie, you know, except the movie the Irwin brothers are making today, which are really good. There's some great movie coming out, film stuff coming out, that's really good. But most, it sends you these messages. And it begins to mold and shape your brain, even when you don't realize it, into thinking something. And so therefore, you've got your friends, and they're doing all this stuff. You're a Christian, and you're like, I don't know if that's wrong or right. It seems judgmental for me to tell my friend that they shouldn't be doing this. It seems judgmental for me to tell my friend that, you know, because I don't know. And you begin to get your mind shaped by something. And then you're being lied to, and you say, okay, well, I mean, that's true with sex, that's true with money, that's true with the goal you're going after in life, that's true in your marriage. You know, you see many people told that, man, I mean, she doesn't make me happy, God doesn't want me to be unhappy, and so, man, it's about me. I mean, these are the messages that you get, and you begin to believe them, and you don't even really know you're believing them. Your worldview is just being shaped, and so you begin to be confused when real life hits you. You know who lies to you bad is your emotions. Your emotions lie to you badly. You need to understand that. You know, I hear all the time, especially in romantic language, romantic context, follow your heart. I don't know if you watch The Bachelor or Bachelorette, but you watch The Bachelor or Bachelorette, you know, and I mean, their parents are always on there at the end, or they bring a former Bachelor or Bachelorette on there, and they're always like, hey, you just need to follow your heart. I'm standing up screaming going, yeah, and you're going to end up just like every one of them. About 3 weeks, you're out. Follow your heart. You know, if my sons, thank God, my two older sons are married, got great wives, and my younger son's not old enough to be on there, but if he were and I showed up to help him, he'd say, Dad, I just need some advice. And I'd say, son, whatever you do, don't follow your heart. It's evil. It's going to lie to you. Lead your heart. Don't follow it because your emotions lie to you. You know your emotions lie to you, don't you? Let me give you some examples of how your emotions lie to you. My emotions lie to me, right? I mean, you have been through church. I love this church. And, you know, most pastors, I know they love their church. And I've been here for 31 years. And, man, I love this church. And let me tell you, I love this church because we've been through some stuff together, haven't we? I mean, man, we've been through some stuff together. You've been through some stuff with me, man. You've been with me when my dad died, and 2 years later, my mom died in January. My dad died in November. The January two after that, my mom died, and then that same October, my wife died. I'm like, man, you talking about the sometimes life is the semi, and I'm the bug hitting the windshield. That's how I felt. You feel that way sometimes, don't you? Some of you come in here this morning and feel like you're splattered all over the place. I felt that. It was just like a gut punch after gut punch after gut punch. And I couldn't understand it. I'm going to be honest with you. My emotions didn't do me well because my emotions were telling me something was wrong. You see, my emotions were saying, your wife died, and man, she was young. It was unexpected. She served the Lord with gladness. You know her. You know her. If it wasn't for her, I wouldn't have lasted near that long here, right? I mean, you know her. She served the Lord with gladness. She had massive influence in the adoption world nationwide. She had adoption agencies calling her, asking her questions. She had massive influence in our church, in our women's ministry, in me, in our kids. Massive influence. She loves the Lord. I love the Lord. I serve the Lord. Bam, she's not here anymore. Did that make sense to you? Because it didn't make sense to me. And it doesn't make sense to me today. And my emotions can begin to tell me that God's not fair. You know, really, my emotions can begin to tell me that God's just not fair, that God doesn't love you. You did, and even some religions will tell me, I did something wrong. Remember Job's friend, some religious people, you must not be living right. I mean, that's what my emotions can tell me, and I can begin to look down and say, God's not fair. What do I do when, man, I'm the bug and life is the semi? What do I do when I look out and I look through Jesus? Because here's what I know. John the Baptist, he was a great influence because remember John the Baptist. John the Baptist, Jesus said about this man, he is the greatest man to ever live. Remember that? Jesus did. He was Jesus' cousin. Jesus said he's the greatest man to ever live. He baptized Jesus. Baptized Jesus. Man, I was baptized by Benny. He's legend enough, and that hair is crazy, isn't it? But John the Baptist baptized Jesus. John the Baptist is one that looked out and said, hey, whoa, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. He proclaimed Jesus, declared him publicly. That's a great honor. This is John the Baptist, man. But John told the truth. John never compromised. His convictions are the truth. He preached the truth, and he confronted the leader of the known world, the most powerful nation in the world, about his sexual misconduct and sin and extramarital affairs and all this kind of stuff. And so he didn't like it. You don't know what likes to be confronted. He had the power. So he had John arrested, brought in prison, and was awaiting execution. And we all know how that ended, with his head being cut off. But while he was awaiting, the greatest man who ever lived, the man who baptized Jesus, the man who was declared by Jesus the greatest man ever, the man who said, Lamb of God who takes away the world, is in prison getting ready to get his head cut off. Is that fair? What do you think John the Baptist's emotions were doing to him? And he was awaiting in prison and sent word to Jesus and asked the question, am I confused? Aren't you the one? Wait a minute, I thought you were the one. Are you not the one? And Jesus said, because I'm in prison, Jesus. Why are you not doing something about this? Are you not the one? Jesus just sent him word back and said, I am. I am the one. And when you can't see, you trust because I'm truth, basically. When you can't see, trust because I'm truth. Folks, sometimes you just got to trust because you can't see. But here's how you can trust: because Jesus is the truth. He's ultimate reality. He's ultimate reality. And all many, many, many of the things, we live in a world that's broken by sin. And because of that, we will always be stressed. We will always have troubled and heavy hearts, as those disciples did that night. And there will always be confusion with decisions. I don't know what to do. So we need good, godly friends. But we need the word and we need prayer, because Jesus is the truth. And here's what we do. When we're confused about, should I marry this girl? Should I marry this guy? I don't know. Well, a lot of those decisions are made already for you. You see, we stress about our decisions when most of them are already made. If we just look through the lens of the truth. If we look through the lens of the truth. Should I do this? Should I do that? What's the truth say? What does Jesus say about it? Because he's ultimate reality, and he is always right. He is always right. He tells us the truth about sex. He tells us the truth about money. He tells us the truth about forgiveness, because that doesn't make sense to me, forgiveness. That makes no sense to me, guys, to be quite honest. To forgive rather than seek vengeance. But Jesus tells me the truth. You know, he tells me the truth about my marriage. He tells me it's not about me. He tells me it's about him. He tells me it's not about my happiness. It's about my holiness. He tells me it's not about, you know, making my life better. It's about a reflection of his life, the better life that I can give the world. He tells me the truth about marriage. He tells me the truth about parenting. He tells me the truth about relationships. He tells me the truth. And if I look through his lens, most of the stress in my life, the decisions, our stress is never going to go away. But he's the truth. He's the truth, folks. He's not. He's the ultimate reality, the supreme revelation of God. And finally, he's the life. He's the life. Now, Jesus had just declared, told his disciples that he was about to die. And now he declares to be the life. He's about dying. I'm the life. And it's not really confusing because he really means that he is life. Let me explain life in three quick ways for you. This is not I'm not going to preach three separate points because I'm wrapping this up. But let me give you, first, he is life, physical life. All of life comes from Jesus. In the beginning, God created. God said, let there be light. Bam, it happened. God spoke and life emerged. God spoke and life emerged. Everything that exists, man, when you look out right now in the spring and you see the buds on the trees and you see the animals, the greenery, you see a mountain or a stream, God created that. You are here today with blood in your veins and air in your lungs, not because your mom and your dad fell in love and had a moment and it was beautiful and great, and yada, 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 whatever. It was because God, before time began, ordained the day you would be born. He spoke your life into existence, right? All that you see, it didn't happen because of some random mutations that created order from chaos. God spoke life into existence. If you're here, if you're living and breathing, it's because God gave you life. You have physical life because God granted you that life. That's why when you see him walk through the pages of the New Testament, when he tells Lazarus, get up and come out the grave, Lazarus does because God's in charge of life. God's in charge of life. He gives life. Matter of fact, that's the theme throughout John, isn't it? He brings dead things to life because he's life. But it's not just physical life, I exist. It's not just bios, I exist. But he gives me spiritual life. He gives me rebirth. Because I was born physically alive, but when I was born physically alive because of Adam and Eve's sin, I was born spiritually dead. You know, I was born with my heart beating physically, but my spiritual heart was black and dead and numb because my first parents, Adam and Eve, well, they sinned and they passed that along. I was born that way. I was born dead. I was born dead. And so what does he do? That we live our life. We're born physically alive and spiritually dead, and we live that way. And as we come through, you know, infancy and childhood and adolescence and into adulthood and all these things, and we can't make it fit. We don't know what's wrong, and we're searching here and we're searching there. We look out, we see the junk in the world. We have no answer because our heart is spiritually dead. It's dead, folks. It's not beating until Jesus breathes life into our dead souls. And he calls us to himself. And he gives us life. He gives us spiritual life. And we think, okay, that's great. But that's not just, you know, we have now eternal life, which begins the day we're saved. We have eternal life, but that's not the end of the story. If that was what your salvation was all about, eternal life going to heaven, then it would have been better for God, for you, it would have been better for God to, the moment you were saved, just to bring you on to heaven, wouldn't it? I mean, you're here, saved, in the midst of a turbulent world that causes all this trouble in your life. And your heart to be stressed and worried. And you can be in heaven where there is, like where Amy is today that I talked about a moment ago, you can be in heaven to where, man, there's no disease, there's no tear, there's no crying. I mean, as much as she loved me, she wouldn't come back to me right now if she could. Not for a moment. Because it's that good. It's what we long for. See, some of you don't think, man, I don't know if I think about heaven a lot. I'm telling you that you think about heaven all the time. You just don't call it heaven because you think about how life could be right. You think about it much more than you know. When you see disease, you're like, why is that? You think about it so much more than you know. And why would we be here if we could be there if that was the ultimate? And yes, we get to go to heaven, but he didn't. He saved you to represent him here, and until the Father calls you home, or the moment the day he set aside for the Son to return and get his bride, we're here. And so between the here and now, there's this abundant life. You got physical life, spiritual life, and abundant life. That means life to the max, life to the full, life over the top, life like you want it to be. It can be that, right? Now, it can be until we get to heaven, it's going to be muted. The colors are going to be muted. The sound's going to be turned down, all that kind of stuff because of sin. But we can have life with purpose and meaning and fulfillment. We can. Because of Jesus. Because of Jesus makes all those things begin to come together in an amazing way, and life begins to take more color and sounds more beautiful, and in the midst of everything. He doesn't say he's going to take your pain away, your trouble away. Look at the disciples, folks. Man, every one of them died for Jesus except John, and he did, you could say, but he was boiled in oil, legend has it, and imagine what kind of life that would have been. After that, the pains and the aches, but he's still alive for the glory of God, and so your trouble's not going to be taken away, but you go through that with a purpose and a sense because you know the Son's coming back for me on the day the Father has said. He's preparing a place for me. He's coming back for me on the day the Father has said. It's amazing. Right? It's amazing. You can have an abundant life. Why? Because you see, here's the thing. Everybody knows that they're born with a dead heart. Now, they don't know how to say that, and they might not know how to process that, but they know they're born with a dead heart. And so we have this, you know, some of the philosophers say this God-shaped hole. I forget which one. My mind went blank. This God-shaped hole in our soul that only God can fill. We do. And so we try to work our way back to God, and here's what happens. Man, we continually believe that it's about our works, that it's about what we do, it's about creating our own righteousness. And, you know, that's what even the Israelites thought. That's what the Jews, the Pharisees that were after Jesus, that's what they thought. And it didn't create life, it created death. Imagine that. God didn't give the law. He didn't give the Ten Commandments and the law so that people could have life. Sure, he gave it all and said, if you keep it 100%, you're perfect. Yeah, he gave it to us to show us we can't create our own righteousness. When I look at the law, man, it takes me about 2 seconds to go, oh, blown it, can't do it. Yep, I can't do it. I cannot do it. I can't keep the law. And so, man, when I try to earn my way to life, when I try to earn a heartbeat spiritually, I try to earn my way to life, it sucks the life out of me. And it does the world. It's life sucking. It's not life giving. It sucks the life out of you because you can do it and you think, oh, I'm doing pretty good. Man, I feel pretty good today because I'm doing pretty good. And I look at that joker and look at him. Man, he's terrible. So I feel really good. And we start basing our off of everybody else's righteousness. And I always find some joker that's a lot worse than me. And so we base it off everybody else's righteousness. And so I do good, and I'm okay. And then I blow it, and then I'm like, oh, God doesn't love me. I don't have any life. And man, that's not abundant life. That's life sucking. That's not life giving. I have so many people tell me, it's like, you know what I like? You're just so real. You're just so real. You'll stand, and you're just so real. You just tell us what's going on in your life, and you're just so real. I mean, yeah, I don't know if that's right or wrong, but it's what I do. Why? Because here's why. Because I made a decision a long time ago. I'm not going to try to act like I'm something I'm not, and I'm not going to try to give you a righteousness. My righteousness won't even get me to heaven, let alone yours. It won't get me there. My righteousness is as filthy rags, as Paul said. It won't get you anywhere. It won't get me anywhere. It's not my righteousness. It's Jesus' righteousness. It's his. It's his righteousness. And man, when he gives us his righteousness as a free gift of grace that can never be revoked for those who truly receive it, man, now I can live life abundantly. I can live it abundantly. I don't only have spiritual life. I have this real abundant life because I have a relationship with Jesus. He's the way, he's the truth, and he's the life. It's not what you know that gets you to heaven. Or gives you real, true, abundant life. It's who you know. Do you know Jesus? It's a simple question. Do you know Jesus? Man, we're going to give you an opportunity to respond. And here's an amazing thing I realized backstage today when I was talking to some of our folks. Man, I don't know. The last 3 or 4 weeks, here's what we've noticed. We've given you an opportunity to respond. And man, we've been having people come down and confess sin. We've been having people come down and say, I need you to pray for my mama, my daddy. My health. We've been having people come and pray. People come and fall. And here's what's crazy about that. 4 weeks ago, and I honestly, I didn't put it on. 4 weeks ago, our worship team, our worship team and our production people, they come every morning. They get here like, man, like, I mean, the Lord's not even up when they get here, like at 5 a.m. or something. They get here like early to rehearse, but they started getting here early, but before rehearsal, they stop. They get set up and they get tuned up, you know, all that. And then they go out and they just start praying over all these seats. They started that 4 weeks ago. 4 weeks ago, we began to see some crazy things begin to happen. Man, people getting saved. Prayer's important. You look at Acts, the New Testament, you see several things. You see a church, you see a kingdom exploding. You see a kingdom exploding. And two things that are prominent within that are the word being preached and prayer. And prayer. And folks, we're coming into a time of Easter when, man, we can see a lot of people come to know Jesus during this Easter season. And it's not you. It's not me. You know me. My words are not intelligent enough or smart enough to save anybody, but God can. It's God that saves. And would you ask him to save somebody? It's that simple. Man, if you know somebody that's lost, and if you don't, my goodness, where you live? I mean, if you don't know somebody that's lost, where do you live? You know, what are you doing? You know somebody that's lost, and ask God to save them. Ask God to bring them with you to church. Ask God to bring them to his kingdom. Ask God to save them. And so here's what I want you to do. Right now, would you all stand? Our band's going to come out, but I want to give you a moment. Would you all stand? And right now, here's what I want you to do. Bow your heads, and I just want you to spend a moment in prayer. I want you to say, if you don't know Jesus, you're watching online, if you don't know Jesus, you text the word Jesus to the number on the screen, and we will get back with you and help you process this walk and how to give your life to Jesus. If you're in the room, online, either one, I just want you to pray. You don't know Jesus. Jesus, please reveal yourself to me. Help me to know you're real. That's your prayer if you don't know Jesus. If you do, I don't know what you need to pray about. God could have convicted you of some sin that I didn't even preach about today, because that's what the Holy Spirit does. He's God. He could just laid something on your heart to pray about that I didn't preach about, because that's God. But would you ask God to save somebody that you know? I'm going to give you a moment to pray just where you are. Michael's going to play just very calmly here for a moment over you, give you a moment, minute or so to pray. And then some of our staff that's in the room, they'll be down here. If you want Jesus, the Holy Spirit's calling you, come and talk to them. You want to pray for your mama? Man, if your mama's lost, pray for your mama. If my mama was lost, I'd be on my knees begging, crying for God to save her. Maybe you're praying for your daddy that's lost. Maybe you're praying for a child that's lost or a friend that's lost. Pray for people to be receptive when you go door hanging this week. Get those door hangers as you leave. Pray for people to be receptive. Would you come and pray? Maybe just fall on your knees and say, God, I'm praying that John is saved. Only you can do it, and I trust you to do it. Let's see God do great things. When Michael starts singing, some of our staff will be up here. You come, but you don't need our staff. You can go straight to the Lord. That's the great thing about Jesus being our high priest. You can go straight to him. So you can come and kneel. You can come to one of our staff. Please pray God moves on Easter. Let's do that. Let's come down forward. Let's do that. Some of our staff, if you'll come up, and people need you. Our staff's here because they love you and want to pray for you. When Michael begins to sing, you come, you pray, you do what God leads you to do.